You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, nearly 13,000 Afghan refugees are at Fort McCoy in western Wisconsin. Reporters got their chance to tour the base for the first time this week. We'll talk to a reporter who was there about the stories she heard from refugees waiting to resettle. Now, faced with several crucial deadlines, some of which were self-imposed, Congress had a packed day yesterday. They passed a continuing resolution to keep the government open, at least until December. But while the House passed a bill suspending the limit on government debt earlier this week, the Senate may have a tougher road. And the big news of the day that we're following, still tension within the Democratic Party that's holding up passage of two different pieces of infrastructure investment and social policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you following all the twists and turns in this ongoing story? Bigger picture, are you hoping something comes out of this when it comes to putting a chunk of money into things like roads and bridges and rail and other infrastructure, internet? And do you want to see the bigger 10-year bill get passed that has a lot of social policy-related spending in a lot of different areas? What's a priority to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alisa Von Hagel is professor of political science at UW-Superior. Alisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me today.
We're going to spend most of our time on these infrastructure bills. I want to touch briefly, though, that the federal government did not shut down at midnight this morning, and it won't, at least until December. What happened?
Which is, it's a success in part, I suppose, but at least we have that. We have the appropriations, a continuing resolution that will at least keep the doors open till December 3rd, which hopefully that by then they can come together and pass the appropriations deal that they need to, that will last for the entire year. But, it's knock on wood, I suppose, in that hope.
And then between now and then, we could default on our debt if the debt ceiling isn't increased. Another one of these really ongoing deadlines that comes up again and again and again. It seems like probably one way or another that debt ceiling will be suspended. How big a deal is it if it didn't get raised?
So, the limit or the time frame that it needs to be dealt with is by October 18th. And if it doesn't get lifted or suspended or dealt with in some fashion, it's very, it'll be hugely important for not only the U.S., but the global economy. And it can be very problematic, to say the least, if that debt limit isn't dealt with. It was in a few years prior to now, it was raised given the COVID pandemic spending. That was a bipartisan lifting of the debt ceiling. And as of right now, it is something that is become a much more partisan issue. So that will most likely in the coming weeks become a big political issue.
That takes us to the infrastructure bill. Still, neither of them passed. For people who aren't following the twists and turns closely, and I don't blame people if they aren't, we'll see what comes out of this. Can you remind us what are the two tracks going on here?
Right. So we have an infrastructure bill that's sort of the key part of Biden's agenda that is not only physical infrastructure, but also includes money for high-speed internet, airports, Amtrak, just a whole host of projects to not only focus on physical infrastructure, but also kind of thinking about infrastructure in a much broader sense. And it's being held up currently by liberal Democrats, the liberal Democratic wing, who wants a simultaneous vote on the social policy reconciliation bill. And if that is not to happen, then they refuse to vote yes on the infrastructure bill.
Looking at the timeline, President Biden came over to Capitol today with a lot of people on his team to encourage or shake down his party members. I'm not sure which, but one thing he did say was, we're going to pass this, and it doesn't really matter if it happens in 6 minutes or 6 days or 6 weeks. I'm paraphrasing there. Obviously, 6 minutes has already passed since he said that. But since we're looking at bills that one of those that you just mentioned would be a 10-year plan, does it matter that much? Should we be too excited if it doesn't pass today but passes, 3 weeks from now?
That there won't be any major, ideally there wouldn't be, you know, significant policy changes or impact if it was passed, like you said, in say 2 to 3 weeks from now. I think it will continue to perhaps cause a, you know, more and more of a political nightmare for the Democrats, especially if it is continually, the vote is pushed back. And so I think it's more so a problem for, you know, politics and the, you know, how people view what Congress is doing or not doing, as a, as more so as delaying the actual voting on the bill itself. So it's merely going to just hurt Democrats if the, the vote is delayed or they are unable to secure the vote, you know, in a timely fashion.
We're talking to Elisa Von Hagel, professor of political science at UW-Superior, looking at infrastructure plans, two of them still before Congress, still stumbling blocks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on what you want to see happen? Do you want to see either or both of these bills passed, or do you want to see either or both of them rejected? Is there something you've been following, a particular issue in this? And there's a lot, from roads to climate change to childcare funding to prescription drug negotiation, so much in here. Is there a particular element that you have been following most closely? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Elisa, with all these different issues contained within these two efforts, what stands out to you as things that one way or another would impact the lives of Americans here in Wisconsin in particular?
So I think both bills, the infrastructure bill as well as the social policy reconciliation, will dramatically impact the life, like the immediate lives of people all around the country, even in Wisconsin. So, you know, infrastructure, obviously physical infrastructure, roads, highways, bridges, that's money that has been not granted for to states for so long. And we do have, you know, in some places very, you know, crumbling infrastructure that it is, you know, absolutely necessary to get that through and passed to improve so that, again, people are safe essentially in, you know, buildings, roads, highways, and whatnot. And with respect to the social policy bill, you know, there's a lot of focus on climate change or ways to combat climate change. There's extension of the child tax credit, universal pre-K, paid leave, Medicare expansion. So there are a lot of programs in there that are designed to help, you know, families, working families in need. And so it, you know, both bills absolutely would immediately affect the lives and well-being of people all throughout the country.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ken is with us in Green Bay. Ken, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Ken?
You know, it's, you know, the bill right now, a lot of people are saying on the infrastructure, it's going to cost a lot of money, but nobody's really talking about how much more money it's going to cost us in the future to fix our infrastructure that's already depleted. You know, what additional costs are going to come because, you know, the infrastructure is just going to keep crumbling and cost more money down the road. It's not just going to cost the same $5 million today. It's going to cost maybe 10 to 15 because of the additional damage that's being done. I was wondering if there's been any other discussion on that from your side.
Ken, thanks a lot for that call. So a stitch in time, basically. Elisa, is this something people are talking about, maybe overdue investment that the longer we wait, as Ken is saying, might cost us more down the road, literally on the road?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. It is absolutely correct. I mean, infrastructure is something that we have ignored or just pushed aside for so long, and we have allowed, again, all of our physical infrastructure to, you know, in some places literally decay. And as the caller mentioned, could very well do so in the coming years. And so absolutely, if this bill isn't passed now, it will absolutely be so much more expensive to deal with a lot of the, you know, physical infrastructure issues that we have, as well as, again, you know, the funding for Amtrak and airport security. I mean, all of these things are crucial. And so certainly it will cost us more down the road if we don't pass this bill currently, or today, or not necessarily today, but in this session of Congress.
We're talking to UW-Superior political science professor Elisa Von Hagel, looking at the differences among Democrats in Congress trying to agree on priorities for two major infrastructure and social policy packages. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Are there elements in either of these bills that you are following closely, ones you think might affect you, your life, your pocketbook, your community? What do you want to see come out of all this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about Congress working on reaching a deal on infrastructure and social policy spending packages. Elisa von Hagel stays with us, professor of political science at UW-Superior, and you can join in with your thoughts, your hopes and fears for these packages, and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elisa, there's been some bipartisan support for the straight-up infrastructure side of these. I'm the other one with the bigger number attached to it. Republicans have raised questions about expanding the role of government beyond what they'd like to see. Childcare and things like that sound nice, but is it the job of the federal government? And some moderate Democrats, a couple in the Senate in particular, raising some of those same questions. Do you have thoughts on that?
Right, absolutely. So the Republicans, especially in the Senate, have uniformly agreed that they are opposed to this bill, will not vote for it. And thus, because of the makeup of the Senate today, which is basically a 50-50 split, Democrats have to maintain, all 50 Democratic votes to pass this bill. And so there are two moderate Democrats, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kristen Sinema of Arizona, are not in support of the social policy reconciliation bill and thus have refused to, or not agreed to this particular bill or even a different version of this bill with perhaps lesser spending. There's still ongoing negotiations with that respect. So it is the moderate Democrats that are holding up this social policy reconciliation bill, although they are also the ones that are much more in demand, are demanding that the infrastructure bill is passed, as that is something that is so crucial to the needs of the constituents in their particular states.
And then, of course, another objection that's out there is concerns about spending increases, national debt increases involved in this. Democrats are trying to have things to pay for some of the spending, but probably that's not all going to be there. On top of tax cuts a few years back, how big are the concerns about this driving up the national debt?
I mean, I think there is some, reason to be concerned for that. The original bill that was proposed was much, much higher. It's been pared back dramatically. But even still, even though there is, some measures that are designed to, offset the cost, the extra cost, as well as, tax increases for corporations and the wealthy, there are many who have said that it's still not enough to carry or to offset all the cost of all of these new programs. And so that is something I think that's important to consider and to evaluate. And so for the American people, the question is, are these programs something that, you believe would be of, value to you, your family, your neighbors, your community? And so because there's so much packaged in this reconciliation bill, there's, I think something for everyone. And it's one of those things that it's hard to pick and choose, which to remove or take out or to reduce the spending that has been requested by others. And so, but again, yes, the cost is something to consider.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us now in La Crosse. Chris, hi.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. So my question is, the progressives are holding up the vote on the bipartisan bill, but if it really is bipartisan, why can they even do that? Why won't the Republicans just throw them 20 or 30 votes or whatever they need to pass it and stop letting them screw around with this?
Chris, thanks for that call. Yeah, it's gotten bipartisan support in the Senate. So what's happening with Republicans in the House? As Chris said, if enough of them voted for it, it wouldn't matter if House Progressive Democrats opted out of it.
Right. And so there's about a 100-member caucus of progressive liberals. And so the number of votes to offset those, you know, 100 or so progressive Democrats would, you know, is a lot for the Republican caucus. And there has been, even though it is a bipartisan bill, there has been, I guess more polarization and more focus on sort of letting the Democrats like figure it out for themselves, so to speak. And thus they have been more so inclined to not support these measures, basically to ensure that the Democratic agenda is not passed.
Thanks for the call, Chris. We'll go now to Becky in Houstonsford. Becky, hi.
Hello there. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a vested interest, shall we say, in wanting the infrastructure bill to pass because I have inspected heavy construction in the past, roads, bridges, underground sewer and water systems. So I have an ulterior motive to want that to continue. But the social infrastructure bill is every bit or perhaps more important because, and I don't know why Republicans want to shoot the American business community in the foot, because all of the countries that we compete against head to head have early childhood programs. They have health care systems that don't put that burden on businesses and especially on the small businesses that we do. And in so doing, we keep handicapping our business community. And for them to fight against that and say that somehow it's adding too much to the national debt, I have yet to hear any of the Republicans apologize for the trillions of dollars the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq cost us because we took our eye off the prize going after Osama bin Laden and went into Iraq and bungled Afghanistan.
Becky, thanks for the call. Becky, getting at one of the hearts of the argument over, you know, the Biden administration originally calling the what's now the reconciliation plan an infrastructure plan, human infrastructure, social infrastructure. What do you think of that debate, Elisa?
I mean, unfortunately, the caller is absolutely correct that these bills have become overtly politicized. And because they are so clearly seen as the Biden agenda, they, you know, the fact that the Republicans are not supporting or in support of these bills that would, in fact, definitely support help their constituents and their interests is, you know, to because of the midterm elections and, you know, the hope that they could limit Joe Biden to a one-term presidency. So it is, you know, very overtly political in their, you know, their actions right now is to, you know, basically stymie the agenda simply because it is a Democratic president's agenda. And it's very much been focused on as, you know, President Biden's agenda specifically. And so, unfortunately, that's led to this impasse and, you know, continued debates and meetings and whatnot.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to a political scientist, Elisa von Hagel from UW-Superior, looking at the latest on efforts to pass infrastructure bills in Congress. Paused, but not over the debate there. Back to your calls now. Heather is on the line in Madison. Heather, hi.
Hi. I just want to say a couple of things. One is I think this has been a complete debacle I think that your guest is right, that the Republicans are just sitting back and laughing and saying, okay, we're not going to help you. And you guys are basically self-destructing from the inside out, and they're loving it. But I think the biggest problem here is that we, the American people, are the ones who are suffering. And this isn't a new story with Congress because these guys can't produce anything. If they were actually a company, they'd all been fired. But the reality is that we need this. We need both of these bills. This is an economic development issue for our country. Are we going to be competitive?
Heather, we lost you there, but cutting in and out. Heather hit the point I think she was trying to make, though, Elisa. She thinks these bills were missold and could have been sold more as economic development packages. What do you think?
It's possible, definitely, that there could have been a better like PR message, I suppose, for the American people on these particular bills. But I think it's important to remember, too, that, you know, these members of Congress that are holding up votes on, you know, one or the other bill, that it's not just themselves in particular, but They also have constituents that have very strong opinions on these issues. They have donors, lobbyists, activists, organizations that are all, you know, calling them, lobbying them. I mean, Joe Manchin had a group of kayakers come up to his houseboat where he lives in Washington, D.C. to basically barrage him with questions on this. And so, you know, they have many, many different groups that they are accounting to. And so, again, unfortunately, it's led to this, you know, political, very politicized, you know, debacle, essentially. And unfortunately, because of the lack of perhaps better messaging or better salesmanship, it's, as of right now anyway, sort of come to a stalemate.
Alisa, thanks for that call. Alisa, just in our last minute or so, what are you watching for signs of the outcome here?
So I think that, so Pelosi has said, you know, many times in her tenure, but also more recently with respect to these bills, that a bill or a vote would not be brought to the floor of the House until an agreement is, you know, found on the Biden agenda more generally. And so if there is a vote that's called, then it means that they have the support essentially for the infrastructure bill. And so again, when we don't hear a vote being called, then we can assume that there's still these holdouts and these battles. And it's hard to say if this will be, you know, a couple of days, a couple of weeks. It's really absolutely impossible to know at this point.
Alisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alisa von Hakel is a professor of political science at UW-Superior. We talked to her today about Democrats' negotiations over two different major infrastructure and social policy efforts and what the results could mean for the American people. There are close to 13,000 Afghan refugees staying at Fort McCoy in western Wisconsin. The base had been closed to the media for weeks, but after some refugees raised concerns about conditions there, reporters got their first chance to tour the facilities yesterday. Our next guest was one of those reporters and has been closely following what's happening at Fort McCoy. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234 about the resettlement process. And there are drives to pull together clothing and other necessities for the people living there. Have you participated in that? Are you organizing that in your community? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Emily Hamer is a county government and criminal justice reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, you were part, as I mentioned, of a group of reporters who got to tour Fort McCoy for the first time since Afghan refugees arrived. Can you share some of the stories you heard from the people you met there?
Yeah, so I got to meet three Afghan evacuees who are staying there up at the base in Fort McCoy. One of them, he was a helicopter pilot for and he assisted the U.S. Army and other people who were in his same position. He said that they got assassinated by the Taliban and he had to hide from the Taliban while he was in Afghanistan. Another was actually an NPR reporter. So she was reporting from Kabul, and another was a Paralympic wheelchair basketball player. She wanted to leave Afghanistan because she couldn't play basketball there anymore. Another was a women's rights advocate who her work would have put her in danger had she stayed in Afghanistan.
And we see a lot of statistics. We see the numbers of people and sort of the general category of Afghans resettling here in the United States. What was it like to actually, you know, have names and faces and personal stories and just and bring these to life for your readers?
Yeah, their stories are just, they're so amazing. And I was really struck by, in particular, how grateful they are just to be here. I would expect them to be more angry with the U.S. government, but they just are happy to be alive and happy to start their lives here. And they want to be contributing members to the U.S.
Can you paint us a picture of what this, in effect, temporary city looks like?
Yeah, what really stuck out to me was just there are so many children there. Nearly a half of the roughly 13,000 Afghan refugees there are kids. So you can see them kind of riding around on bikes, playing frisbee, playing soccer. They had a soccer game there. They were in a soccer field, and other adults were cheering them on. There was also a craft center, and people, or the kids were making fall trees out of construction paper. Just lots happening. It really does seem kind of like a little city. And then the base itself is kind of rows and rows of these buildings with white siding and a red roof. And those are the housing buildings. There's about 250 of them. And that's where the Afghans are staying, about 60 people inside of one building. That's a barracks style building.
You had reported last month on concerns about conditions at the base. You were able to talk to a couple of the Afghans living there. What kind of concerns were they raising?
The Afghans I talked with yesterday, they didn't really have any concerns. They were pretty happy with the conditions there. But I will note that they showed us the official showed us a clothing distribution facility. And while it is great that so many people have donated and that there's so many donations, that roughly 1,200 Afghans still had not gotten a new set of clothes when we were there Thursday morning. They said that that should be fixed today, and that everyone in the base should at least have gotten a chance to get one new set of clothing.
We are talking to Emily Hamer from the Wisconsin State Journal. She was one of a group of journalists who got the first tour at Fort McCoy since Afghan evacuees arrived there. And Emily, I used the phrase refugees loosely earlier. You talked to people about their process in trying to get visas, many trying to get special immigration visas who had worked with the United States in Afghanistan. What did you hear from people about what that process is like for them?
I didn't really get to talk with them much about that. We only got 10 minutes with each person. So it was really kind of just focused on who they are and their experience getting here to the U.S. But yeah, right now they're just kind of waiting for their papers to get processed. An official with the Department of State said that Fort McCoy is getting close and to being able to really resettle large groups of people. They have to complete their immigration processing and medical screenings. Not really much info on the timeline for that, though.
There have been a couple reports of crimes at the base. Can you tell us about that and what you heard from officials there?
Yeah, there were, I think last week they arrested two men. One of them, he's a 20-year-old man. He was arrested for sexually assaulting two of the boys on base. They were only 12 and 14 years old. There were multiple incidents of that. Another man was charged with allegedly choking and suffocating his wife. Really kind of gruesome stuff. The officials there, though, said that they have police. There's a police presence there, and that's a relatively small number of crimes for a city this size. They're calling it a city, and that the security situation there is under control.
A big picture, is there a thought of how long we'll have this city in effect at Fort McCoy? Is it going to go away suddenly, or is it just going to be a steady trickle as people get that legal status and then settle into their new homes somewhere in the United States?
That's really unclear to me, and I think it's also unclear to the Afghans who are staying there. One of the women that I talked with for my initial story said they told her it could be 2 to 6 months before she can get resettled, even though she had her special immigration visa. But that kind of changes every day. So I don't know how long they'll be there and how quickly they'll be able to get resettled.
You mentioned that clothing exchange, and in your reporting, you mentioned that there are efforts, there are drives going on around the state actually to gather materials. What kind of things are going on?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is that Fort McCoy has partnered with the Salvation Army. So if anyone is interested in donating, they can bring their clothes to a local Salvation Army, and those will be able to get up to the base and actually be given to people. They're looking for either new clothing or gently used clothing and freshly washed, just so that people can have something that's wearable there also is, they're looking for cash donations online, and there's an Amazon wish list where you can buy some things and then ship them up to Fort McCoy as well.
Yeah. What, again, you only had 10 minutes per person, but did you hear some of the things that seem to be of greatest need, at least as of yesterday?
Yeah, I think winter coats are still in really great need. I think they really want that. In terms of the clothing, they've officials told me before that one thing they do need is clothing in smaller sizes, that the men and women there are typically just smaller than we are here in the U.S. And there are also tons of children there, so children's clothing and shoes as well.
So you got this access to the base and this city of Afghan evacuees yesterday. What questions do you still have as you continue to follow this story?
I'm wondering whether there are still any, or whether there are other active investigations at the base. I feel like it's probably not the end of crimes there with these two arrests, but I guess I don't know that. I also really want to know how long this is going to take. I haven't gotten any good answers on that, of how long the resettlement process is going to take. So I think that's a big question for everyone, especially the Afghans who are there just kind of sitting and waiting.
We'll leave it there, Emily. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's reporter Emily Hamer from the Wisconsin State Journal with us today to share some of her reporting on Afghan refugees at Fort McCoy. She was part of a group of reporters who were able to visit the resettlement site there and meet with some of the evacuees. Coming up, we'll talk to the head of an organization working to launch an effort to provide legal help to those evacuees at Fort McCoy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you made a donation to help Afghan refugees staying here? Many are in the middle of the immigration process. Have you been through that process yourself? Any words of wisdom about what the process was like for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about Afghan evacuees currently staying at Fort McCoy near Toma. Many of them are in need of legal help navigating the immigration process. A group at the UW-Madison Law School hopes to provide legal assistance and resources to help. You can join in if you have thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Aaron Barbato is director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW-Madison Law School. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Good morning, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us about the legal aid your group is hoping to be able to provide for evacuees at Fort McCoy and elsewhere?
Certainly. Currently, there is a legal clinic on the ground at Fort McCoy run by the United States Catholic Conference of Bishops. And I've been supporting them a little bit with volunteer work, as well as other attorneys are going up there to help provide legal resources to the people that are staying at Fort McCoy from Afghanistan. And my students in my clinic are also doing a lot of research and looking to help represent people who need representation in the process of applying for status here in the United States, who are from Afghanistan.
I've talked to you in the past about asylum seekers, for example, at the southern border. There are people with refugee status looking to come into the United States. This is kind of a different case. Can you talk about the unique legal aspects for Afghans, many of whom are seeking these or in process of getting these special immigration visas?
No, it's such a good question, and that's where a lot of the confusion comes in. So we have this refugee and asylum law where in the United States where we offer protection to people who can't return to their home country for fear of persecution. And many of these people who have fled and evacuated Afghanistan, many of them would qualify as technically as refugees or asylees, but many of them have gone through the process or started the process to apply for a special immigrant visa, which is a faster way to be on a pathway to citizenship and receive protection in the United States. But many of their process was cut short because of the emergent need of them to leave. And so now they're here in the United States and they've been here and they're being vetted, but their pathway to citizenship is a little bit unclear right now.
And I imagine, I mean, these are people who had to leave in many cases in a hurry. Does that mean, you know, maybe the documentation they'd been halfway through or the identification, things like that, might have been left behind, making it more difficult now?
That can be the case. Many of the people that I met with at Fort McCoy, they had all of the evidence, an overwhelming amount of evidence, these textbook cases, which would allow them to qualify for asylum. But obtaining a special immigrant visa here in the United States is not really the process that is available. Normally, you have to have the SIV, the special immigrant visa, prior to departure from your home country. But they didn't have the way to stay there and wait for their interview to get the visa. They still would qualify for the visa, but it's just based on their location right now. And so if someone was expecting to get an SIV in this expedited way of obtaining benefits and citizenship, and now they may be forced to go through the asylum process in the United States, which may take years, it's not what our country promised them.
What would have to happen to turn that process back on again and expedite that, even though it happens to be in not the usual place?
It's such a good question, and I'm surprised more people aren't really talking about it, but there could be a way to have Congress act and create something similar to like the Cuban Adjustment Act, a special Afghan Adjustment Act that would allow people that had worked for our country, people that we had promised a special protection, to adjust their status here in the United States to that of a lawful permanent resident in a more expedited way. Or there have been some talks about expediting, having a special process for asylum for people from Afghanistan, so they don't have to wait in these incredibly long lines that most people who are seeking protection have to.
We're talking to Aaron Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW-Madison Law School, looking at the legal situation for Afghan evacuees currently living at Fort McCoy in Wisconsin and at other military bases around the country. Aaron, is it clear for an Afghan refugee or a lawyer working with them, like, who to go to? Like in the bureaucracy to take the next step for their special immigration visa?
It's very difficult. The Department of State has been managing most of the process for the special immigrant visa, but it's a huge process that involves many different agencies. And now I think our government is very much working towards finding this pathway to citizenship and how do we provide services to the people that we made these promises to had served our country. But some of it is unclear at this point, and many of us are looking for answers, and it's definitely something that's keeping me up at night.
So what are refugees' range of options, assuming they want to live in the U.S. And stay permanently? What has to happen for them to move off of a base and start to find a home to settle into?
Well, in order for them to leave the base, they're going through a process of biometrics checks as well as vaccination and medical checks. And that may allow them, once those have been completed, they may be allowed to leave the base and then resettle with family or other communities where people from Afghanistan are living and then start their lives in the United States. But a big component of that is for them to ensure that they have this pathway to citizenship so that they can build a life here and have permanency here, because this is a country that they are going to have protection in and where they're going to need to start building their lives.
Right. That's a visa. Getting that is not citizenship or a guarantee of citizenship. What has to happen between successfully getting that special immigration visa and then becoming a citizen somewhere down the road?
Well, there's a lot. Normally, when someone would obtain a special immigrant visa in Afghanistan, they would then arrive in the United States, and then upon admission, so once a Customs Border Protection officer saw their visa, determined that they qualified for that visa and admitted them into the United States, they would automatically be a lawful permanent resident, putting them on that pathway to citizenship. So 5 years after obtaining that lawful permanent resident status, as long as they still qualified, they could apply for their to become a U.S. citizen through the process of naturalization. But because people had to depart prior to obtaining that special immigrant visa, they even though they may very well have qualified for them, and almost all of them probably do, they are now kind of in this limbo, this gray area, waiting for more information from our government.
Do we have a sense of how many of the Afghan evacuees at Fort McCoy and elsewhere might end up making their homes here in Wisconsin?
You know, based on just information I've been reading, I've heard that there are about 400 families that will be resettled in Wisconsin, in different areas of Wisconsin, but I don't have a number beyond that. Mm.
Have you talked to refugees there as you're working with them on this legal work, or do you hope to, about their hopes and where they want to live and who they want to live with?
Yeah, no, it's such a good question. Most of the people I talked to had family members already in the United States. And some of the people that I even talked to at Fort McCoy were already U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents, but had fled with family members that didn't have that status yet. So they were waiting to be to go through the process at Fort McCoy before departing. Most of the people that I talked with, some had brothers and sisters in the United States. One man who had worked for the embassy, his parents and his brother and sister were all U.S. citizens living in Arizona. So he was just waiting to be given permission to depart Fort McCoy and then reunite with his family in Arizona. So many of them do have connections in the United States and know the communities where they do want to live and build their lives.
On a practical level, how are Afghan evacuees at Fort McCoy and elsewhere communicating with the State Department? Does the State Department have people on the ground or visiting these resettlement centers? Or is this going back and forth by the mail and the phone and internet, fax? I don't know.
Well, people at Fort McCoy, many of them do have access to the internet and do have their phones. So the Department of State is communicating with certain people, especially with pending special immigrant visas, by email and providing them some updates. But it's nothing as concrete from what I know. But there is ways for people to communicate through their phones and through internet with these agencies. But it's, you know, it's a lot of people and a lot of people we made promises to. And so I think the government, I hope the government is working really hard to come up with these answers to ensure that we're welcoming these people that served our country with dignity.
You mentioned a Catholic legal group working there, your group, the Immigrant Justice Clinic. Is there enough legal help out there, or are you trying to spread the word for people with relevant expertise that their services might be needed?
You know, there will certainly be lots of legal services that are needed to represent people who evacuated Afghanistan or seeking refuge in the United States, whether it's helping them apply for their green cards, their lawful permanent resident status, or if they're, many of them are forced to go through the asylum process. Attorneys definitely will be needed to help represent people in a pro bono fashion, or some people may be able to pay private bar attorneys. But there's a lot of people, tens of thousands of people arriving that will need representation and have someone stand next to them during this process to ensure that they have this pathway to citizenship that we promise them.
In our last minute, you mentioned that Congress could, by passing a law, make a big change here and speed things along. Absent that, at least for now, is there something you'd like to see, especially from the State Department, that could help things out here?
You know, I think definitely more information, more transparency for these people so that they know what is going on. So many of them have suffered trauma based on what happened in their home country, and now they're here without answers of what their future may hold. So transparency is really important, but I also think, you know, providing more information on how they can have this pathway to citizenship here in the United States.
Erin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Erin Barbato, director of the Immigrant Justice Clinic at the UW-Madison Law School. She was with us today to talk about the clinic's efforts to help provide legal aid to Afghan visa applicants at Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin.